And welcome to the KSUT studios, Mr. Nakai. It is a pleasure and an honor to have you here.
Well, I'm finally here, so we took a tour of the city a little bit, and we know where the towers are now.
Excellent. Well, we're glad you're here safe and sound.
Yeah.
And you've been a musical adventurer for many years now, composing, collaborating, performing across a wide range of musical forms and styles, including traditional Native American flute, New Age, world beat, jazz, classical. And could you give our listeners sort of a synopsis about how this long and fruitful journey began for you?
Well, it was actually purely by accident, because I lost my embouchure in the service having a traffic accident and thought my world was over at that time, because I started majoring in music in Flagstaff, Arizona at Arizona State College. And came home. At that time, my girlfriend gave me this instrument. She said, here, this is a native thing. You might like it. I said, what is it? Well, it was a wall hanger from Tava Mawusi over there in Cortez. And it didn't play too well. So I took it apart immediately and said, oh, this is why it doesn't work too well. Put it all back together. It worked fine, but I thought I needed to really do some research. And so I've been doing that ever since. And playing and mixing the genre with other kinds of musical forms from either world communities or from other indigenous communities here in the Americas.
Well, it's definitely been, as I said, a long and fruitful journey for you. And I just want to clarify for some of the listeners who might be unfamiliar with the term embouchure. You initially were a horn player.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the actual, I guess, the mechanics of the flute are totally different than the trumpet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't require a whole lot of musculature, you know. And in fact, the more relaxed you are with flutes, any kind of world flute, then you'll be doing pretty well.
Right. Well, I'd like to keep chatting with you, but first, let's give our listeners a taste of some of your flutes, if you wouldn't mind.
Let me start with the smallest one, which is a birdbone hunting whistle. And there's all kinds of romanticism applied to them, but they were used by people in the old days. I really like the sound. It's very plaintive.
That is amazing. You're correct. I mean, it's very evocative sound. Puts me in mind of nature, wide open spaces, and forests along those lines. And I noticed, you know, since this is radio, I'll explain to our listeners who weren't able to see that, it doesn't appear like there's anything more than just the flute itself and the two holes at the ends, really. There's not a lot of, you weren't doing a lot of fingering. So all that is coming from mouth and tongue control, and
mainly breath control, and then opening and closing the little hole on the end.
Wow!
So the pitch will either go up or come back down.
That is an amazing little instrument.
Mm-hmm.
Do you make the flutes yourselves?
This instrument I do, because I do the actual bone ones for sun dancers and other people who need them for different ceremonies. But the flutes themselves, I work with two flute makers. One lives in Texas, and the other is a flute maker who lives in Arley, Montana, on the edge of the Flathead Indian Reservation. So those two are my flute makers. And I don't know, they may be giving me flutes that are like test models, you know, and they go, here, try this one. I think you'll like it. And I go, let me think.
Who better than you to be the flagship operator of the new flutes?
I guess, yeah.
Well, I've always been interested in the technical aspects of playing a native flute because, as I understand it, it's not, you know, when they're made, they're not really going to be exactly to what, you know, Western music calls a, you know, a 440 or a, you know, a, right. a standard tuning. Mm-hmm. So how do you make that work? How do you...
Yeah, the instruments in the old days, I apply a term arbitrarily tuned. In other words, they used either finger and hand measurements or arm measurements, as was usual with making arrows, the length of the arrow from, let's say, the body of the arrow from the end of your fingers down to the end of your elbow was the length that they used. And so many of the older flutes were about the same length. the finger holes were placed wherever they kind of looked good. And I've seen all kinds of arrangements. There are no octave holes or overblow holes on the back. There's only an arrangement of 4 to 6 finger holes on the top part, and then a sound producing mechanism that's actually pretty involved. And in doing research, found that it actually came from early craftsmen who were making flue pipes for the pipe organs here in the Northeast. Massachusetts, Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, somewhere in that area. And they left a whole bunch of them behind because they weren't quite adequately tuned to A442 as was usual in Europe. So they gave them to the Haudenosaunee people and said, here, make a hole like this with this hot poker and then cover this thing up and it'll make a noise and you can have this whole pile of instruments. And the flue pipes since that time have been dispersed through many different tribes. There are some in New Mexico and here in Colorado, some families who have those original flue pipe flutes. And I would like to have one, but they won't let go of them.
They're not making them that way anymore.
No.
And Well, you do have a panoply of different sized flutes there. Would you mind giving us a sample of lower register flute?
Okay. Let me go to the next one down. This one here is made out of a ABS-style plastic, which is what they use for piccolos and other small instruments. some clarinets, the modern clarinets, are made out of this material too because it's totally inert and it won't shrink or swell when you breathe into it. And in fact, you can clean it out fairly easily.
Beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And to our listeners who have just maybe tuned in, you have just heard R. Carlos Nakai live in the KCT studios. Now, that piece that you just played, is that just off the top of your head an improv?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it's also as I'm playing it, I'm also thinking, if I were singing this, you know, in one of the native languages, how would the vocable sound? So it's something that when you begin learning the instrument, they'll always tell you, well, don't you sing with a powwow group? Just do the same songs that they sing, but do them on the flute and make them sound prettier.
That's a tall order. Yeah,
yeah. Kind of puts everyone on the spot. Yeah.
Yes, indeed. And I know you do have a musical theory background, so how does that enter into your creative process? Are you thinking in terms of, you know, Mixolydian or Aeolian or, you know, scale forms, things like that?
Well, you know, I got into that right away, trying to understand it from a more scientific perspective. But after a while, I thought, nah, just play it. You know, I mean, natives, we don't worry about, well, you know, it's kind of in an Aeolian form, and you've got to do the AB, and then the A1 and the C2 are going to be, you know, it doesn't matter. You have to always remember how it's sung.
Right.
So it has a direct relationship to the vocal music traditions of all the tribes who use this instrument, you know, in the old days.
Wow. And not only do you do a lot of traditional flute playing, you've been involved, as we said at the top of the conversation, with classical orchestras and jazz groups, world music. You've done things with Japanese artists. You've got a total pan-global outlook that has really taken you far, obviously. How does the classical interaction work with you?
Well, that's where the that's where the background in theory and practice comes in, because I also read, and so most of the pieces that I perform on stage require the ability to read notation, and I developed a notational format that's based on the lowest sounding woodwinds flute, which is in the key of E, and actually plays in C minor. Somewhere around Mixolydian, somewhere around Aeolian, somewhere around, oh, just play it. And so reading, now I'll take the original concert pitch score, and then I'll extract the native flute part and then write that down into the tablature, because somewhere in the score, I'm also going to have to change to a flute, maybe an A minor or C minor or D minor. You know, and so I have to be able to not memorize all those different scales like I used to when I was playing at the university level, but I read everything in one line and then notate on the score, this is for the D minor flute. So I'll pick up the right flute for that piece and then play, and then I'll put it down and, you know, return to the original or whatever. So that helps quite a bit. And I'm one about six native people who actually read for this instrument, and it helps a little bit when one is beginning to, let's say, compose new songs for this instrument that are based on the old tribal melodies that we find here and there. And then when that's the case, then all you have to do is look at where your fingers are and then go, oh, that's the lowest pitch. Oh, that's the next one. Two pitches up. And so you write those notations down and then test it out on a piano or synthesizer, and bingo, there it is.
And you'd mentioned the tablature. Your book, The Art of the Native American Flute, was sort of groundbreaking in that you formalized that system of tablature. So people learning the native flutes and everything could sort of be on the same page?
No.
No?
I always, people say, I have your book, and I'm going to learn this flute. And I say, well, don't take the book out until you start playing.
Really?
Yeah, play it first. And then when children and birds and small animals come around to listen, then you might be ready to start writing stuff down. But don't worry about, you know,
don't get the cart before the horse.
Yeah, yeah, it's sort of, people have this understanding that in order to play music, you have to be able to read something on paper Not true at all. Mm-hmm. Country and music people, jazz people, folk musicians all over the world. We were in Scotland recently. There's no notation on paper. They just start playing, you know, and whatever comes out, they go with it. And so, you know, and there are no rules at that point. You just play and have a good time.
Well, that should be the bottom line, I think. Yeah. Play and have a good time.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Well, you'd mentioned jazz, and some of my favorite albums of yours, personal favorites, are the stuff you did with Amo Chip and Will Clipman and Mary Redhouse, you know, the R. Carlos Nakai Quartet. Really interesting the way, just the natural way the flute fit into that jazz sort of context with the world elements and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it works in minor keys, so of course it's going to play blues and jazz really well. And then when I have to move into the major keys or do something different, then I'll pick up either the brass instruments or a concert flute and play those to kind of, you know, get a little more variety with what I'm doing.
Yeah, I recall seeing the quartet. It was a few years back now. I'm not sure what year it was, but it was when Silverton was still doing their little festivals.
Oh, yeah.
Up there. And it was a fun and a very moving gig, too. Mm. It was just very inspiring. So,
yeah.
Very
yeah.
Cool stuff. You've got a recent project with the Philadelphia Orchestra, cellist, and it's called Voyagers. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, that one is another exploration, but this time the person, Udi Bar David, contacted me about playing with he and a number of other members of the orchestra, you know, doing world music and playing improvisationally. And I said, sure, I'll try it. So we have toured on various occasions here on the West Coast and on the East Coast and in Denver. And and then we've since gone and broadened our perspective a little bit. And now Udi and myself and the percussionists, we branched out and work with many different musicians from all over, you know, Africa and the Americas and Asia. And it's very interesting to us when we do that, how similar working improvisationally and just doing music on our traditional instruments, they just sort of come together so easily, you know.
That is great. Well, can I ask you to play one more piece for us before you head on your way?
Okay. Well, let me do the low one. People seem to like the low ones. These are what I call Chief Black and Decker flutes. Because they're so large and heavy that if you put these in your aero bag and then you put it on the side of a dog, the dog would probably fall down after a mile and go, I can't carry this stuff of yours anymore. But it's got a particular sound that I think many people, especially those from the European community or heritage, you know, they kind of glom on too easily.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
R. Carlos Nakai, live in the KCT studios. Well, sir, it has been a pleasure chatting with you and to our listeners. Again, thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.